This is Macro Voices, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Macro Voices episode 360 was produced on January 26, 2023. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by Respect Energy, a leading European trader of renewable energy and a one-stop shop for all green energy investors. Macquarie Chief Macro Strategist Victor Schwitz returns as this week's feature interview guest. We'll discuss the geopolitical outlook, inflation, bond yields, recession risk, equity market outlook, gold, and much more.
And I'm Patrick Ceresna. Listeners, be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment after Eric's feature interview with Victor, when Eric, Nick, and I will discuss the charts on the S&P 500, NASDAQ, VIX, gold, and the oil markets. Now, Eric, before we move on to the feature interview with Victor, let's talk crude oil, starting with the EIA inventories.
EIA inventory came in with a build of 533,000 barrels, but that's really effectively unchanged because it was also a drawdown from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve of 500,000 barrels, about the same amount. Cushing, Oklahoma, building a desperately needed 4.1 million barrels. Let's hope those big Cushing builds keep coming because we sure do need them. Gasoline building 1.8 million barrels. Distillates drawing down 507,000 barrels. U.S. production unchanged at 12.2 million barrels. Tape action was up, then down, then up, then down, and up and down, and up and down, and mostly unchanged. And even as I'm speaking on Thursday morning before the open, it's still right about the same price it was at 80 spot 65 as I'm speaking, just within pennies of what it was before the data came out on Wednesday. The last few weeks, we've had a series of great big, huge inventory builds that would normally be bearish. Prices held up anyway. And then this week, we've got no real build to speak of, you know, 500,000 barrels, but that's against a 500,000 barrel draw on the SPR. And that did not produce a rally. So has something changed, or is it just a case of the market completely ignoring inventory data, perhaps because it's being driven more by demand concerns? I'm not really sure. As far as the China picture is concerned, it seems to be getting clearer now that what we're going to be up against is a really big mess in China as they allow Omicron to burn through the society. And of course, it's a much larger number of people in that country. So just allowing a virus to burn through creates a really big mess. There's a lot of problems going on. But in terms of the longer term picture, what it says is they're going to allow it to burn through and they're going to go ahead and open their economy no matter what. So I think what we can expect is the expected demand increase in China is definitely coming, but it's not going to happen overnight. They need to get through their Omicron crisis before the demand picks up. Overall, I don't rule out more downside. I'm guessing the bottom is probably in, but there's really no new uptrend on this chart until we close over 82 and preferably over 82.50 on front month WTI, and then stay there for a few days. As I mentioned last week, we were approaching that number, got to it, and the markets kind of rolled over, not totally rolled over, but rolled over a little bit. Slow stochastics are starting to turn down. The picture, it looks like maybe we're going to get another wave down. Is it a big wave down all the way back down to 70 bucks again? Or are we maybe going to establish a new upsloping trend line? I'm targeting no lower than 75 or so. I think the bottom is probably in. But if we get a close below 74.50, that would violate the trend line or the formative trend line that I'm looking at and say that maybe there really is more downside to go. I think it depends on what the data says in terms of both whether or not the series of inventory builds is over and also how the China situation evolves.
This week's feature interview guest is Macquarie Chief Macro Strategist Victor Schwitz. Eric, why did we get Victor back on the show this week?
Well, Victor had some very prescient geopolitical calls when we interviewed him 1 year ago, well before the Ukraine invasion. He also has a very strong background in China, having lived there and in Hong Kong for the last 20 years. He's relocated to New York now, but for the last 20 years, he's spent most of his life living in Hong Kong and China. So given the situation there with COVID and also the growing geopolitical tensions, I wanted to ask him about a number of these factors relating to China. And also, it's been a full year since we invited him, and he's a super guy, so we wanted to get him back.
Eric's interview with Victor Schwetz is coming up as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor.
If you invest to bring about a world powered by green energy, you should meet Respect Energy, a leading European trader of renewable energy that serves as a one-stop shop for green energy investors in Europe. Respect Energy brings together independent power producers, accredited and institutional investors holding assets in renewables or undertaking investments in new green energy production, such as wind and solar photovoltaic power plants. More than 600 institutional and accredited investors have already entrusted Respect Energy with the sale of their electricity production, portfolio management, O&M services, EPC, and project development. If you want to invest in green energy in Europe with the help of a trusted partner, contact Respect Energy today and ask for a tailor-made solution. For more information, visit respect.energy.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's your host, Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Victor Schwetz, global strategist at Macquarie Bank. Victor was born in Kiev, Ukraine, and has lived in Hong Kong and China for the last 20 years. So, needless to say, he has quite a bit of perspective in terms of different cultures and the geopolitical situation that the world now faces. Victor, it's great to get you back on. I listened into our interview from 1 year ago, which was also about 1 month before the Russian invasion of your home city of Ukraine, which at the time when you were born was still part of the Soviet Union. The world has changed quite a lot. In our last interview, we discussed geopolitics. You predicted that politics would no longer contain geopolitics and that geopolitics would become a bigger issue as time moved forward. Needless to say, you got that call right. Any particular reflections on the Ukraine conflict and what it means to the global economy?
Well, first, thank you very much for inviting me. Yeah, I still think that geopolitical, social polarization problems that we have been experiencing for the last 10 years will continue to build over the next 10 years, maybe 15 years, maybe longer. I really can't see how politics will be able to control either social tension, polarization tension, or geopolitics for a long time to come. But the interesting thing for me is not so much whether geopolitics will remain contentious or social pressures will remain contentious, but rather geopolitics and politics is more of a process. It's not an event. It doesn't mean that we kill each other every day. It doesn't mean that we confront each other every day. It doesn't mean that it blows up every day. I usually tell my fund management friends that it took Hitler 15 years to come to power. So it's a process, not an event. And so from an investment point of view, I think it's extremely valuable to try to identify periods where you think social and geopolitical pressures will really build up and create a major problems, economic problems, political problems, demand and supply curves, disrupt supply and demand, and at times when those pressures will be relatively subdued. In other words, instead of exploding, they're more likely to simmer. So ultimate destination is still not good. I do think those pressures will build. But I think in 23 and 24, there is a possibility and a strong possibility that those pressures will become a little bit less pronounced. And there are reasons for that. First, if you look at Russia, Ukraine, my view, certainly for the last 12 months, was to say that whatever Russia wants Ukraine to do, Ukraine will never accept. And whatever Ukraine wants Russia to do, Russia will never accept. That basically implies a stalemate. Neither side wins. And yes, you're going to have regular attacks, particularly at the time when the ground is solid. So that's usually in winter or in summer. But at the end of the day, neither party can succeed. Ukrainians are not weak. They're strong and they're determined. And Russia always looks weaker than it is and always look kind of less capable than what it is. And I think Russia is going to be also continue to be a very strong opponent. So what it basically means for 23 and 24, in my view, that bulk of the economic, political and geopolitical impact of Russia-Ukraine war is already behind us. The only question is not destruction of either state, but the question is at which stage we'll start drawing dotted lines on the map. Because as I said, there is no resolution. There is no final resolution to this conflict. But it doesn't mean that the fighting goes on forever. Eventually, there will be some kind of, not reconciliation, but at least dotted lines, whereby you sit here, I sit there, and we agree to disagree. And to me, 23-24 ought to be that period in Russia-Ukraine. At the same time, if you look at other geopolitical hotspots, which is South China Sea and Taiwan, I actually think through the next 2 years, the same would apply to Taiwan, in a sense that one of the lessons China learns from Ukraine is that, number one, Taiwanese are going to fight. Number two, they're going to be armed. Number three, NSA and a private U.S. companies and Pentagon will provide them an edge in the cyber and the cyberspace. I think they have to understand that Chinese need to restructure their armed forces and make them much more mobile, much more independent. And of course, they need to address the issue of economy and monetary system. Remember, Russia was isolated for 8 years before this war. And even then, Russia could not sort of retrofit its system. China is the world's biggest trader. How do you retrofit a system like that against sanctions, against other problems you will have in monetary ways? How do you do that? And the answer, you can't. When people say, well, they should abandon U.S. dollar and sell U.S. treasuries, my answer, and buy what? What are you going to buy? There is nothing else to buy. And there is no substitute for U.S. dollar. And so China needs time to be able to rebuild the trade routes, redirect trading of commodities, redirect trading of products, movement of people, capital, information, gradually build different settlement systems. And maybe then economy can be retrofitted. So one of the lessons of Russia-Ukraine war, to my mind, it's likely to make Taiwan and the challenges in Taiwan less likely, at least in the near term. And so when I look at it, it doesn't mean that there won't be flashes of anger. Of course, there will be. People tend to forget if you think of West Berlin, there were all sorts of heart attacks. There was 1947 airlift. There was 1953 revolution in German Democratic Republic. There was 1956. There was 1961 wall. There was 1968. But ultimately, West Berlin survived through this process. So there will be heart attacks along the way, clearly. But I think at least in the shorter term, the probability of anything significant flaring up is actually down. And we can look at the Middle East, another sort of tectonic plate globally, that again, I think the probabilities today are a little bit less than what they were 12 months or 18 months ago. So my conclusion from a geopolitical perspective is not to say that everything is resolved, nothing is going to be resolved. It's not to say that we're close to agreements. Nobody will ever be close to agreement. But simply to identify, as I said, the times when you have a flare-up and at times when it's likely to become less pronounced. Also remember from China perspective that the only time Chinese would decide to invade Taiwan is that either they're cornered externally and only the United States can do it and they're unlikely to do it, or alternatively, there is some kind of a problem domestically within China. Again, through 2023 and through 24, I just don't see it's happening. So to me, from an investment perspective, I think geopolitics will play a smaller role in the next 2 years than what it did in 2022.
Let's move on and talk about inflation. There's a lot of people who sort of say that, look, this was all about supply chains and COVID. It's over. It's behind us. We're headed back down to 2%. Forget about inflation. It's over. It's done with. Other people are saying, not so fast. Maybe the peak from the COVID crisis is behind us, but there's a new secular trend here. Which is it, and how should we think about inflation going forward?
My answer is actually neither of those answers. One of the things I've been discussing for the last couple of years is that we clearly don't live in 1990s to 2000s. In other words, this was a period of 25 years which was dominated by disinflationary pressures with almost no inflationary offsets. In other words, this was a period of digitization, financialization, and globalization, and no offsetting elements. We're not in that period, but neither are we in 1970s, 1980s, which was a period of consistently inflationary problems with very few disinflationary offsets. The way I basically describe it, we have both. We have inflation and disinflation. The period closer to us is actually 1930s. Than it is either 1970s, 80s, or 1990s to 2000. What does it mean? Well, basically what it means, we still have a very strong disinflationary backdrop. What drives it? Well, number one, financialization and addiction to asset prices and leverage, all of that disinflationary. Number two, technology. As it progresses, it is disinflationary. Number three, demographics. It is disinflationary. Number four, extreme wealth inequalities around the world. Again, disinflationary. But we also have elements of potentially inflationary spikes. What are they? Well, black swans and fat tails. Effectively, the way I look at it, normal distribution of outcomes is no longer the prevailing force. We, in fact, having just too many black swans and fat tails. When you've got that, kurtosis, or the volatility of outcome, increases. And so that's going to be our world for the next 10 years with a much higher degree of volatility. Now, where those black swans can come from? Well, they can come from geopolitics that we've just discussed, which is going to get more complex. The other area could be healthcare. In other words, again, disrupting supply and demand curves as we go forward. Is there anything else that generates inflation on a more consistent basis? Well, a lot of people bring up deglobalization. I actually disagree with that. I don't believe deglobalization is actually inflationary at all. We've been deglobalizing for almost 10 years, and there is no inflationary evidence so far. And we will deglobalize more in the next 10 or 15 years. But I actually don't think there will be a great deal of inflationary pressures. But at the very least, you can argue that deglobalization is not disinflationary the way globalization was in the previous 20, 25 years. There are a couple of reasons why I think deglobalization is not inflationary. Number one, the labor is a smaller and smaller component of the cost structure in arbitrage. Number two, unit labor costs in emerging markets have gone up a lot in the last couple of decades, which reduces the benefit of that sort of arbitrage. Number three, a lot of developed countries are now reindustrializing, particularly United States, in a very different fashion. It doesn't require labor. It doesn't require a lot of fixed assets. It's based around intangible assets, robotics, automation. It's much more flexible, lower cost reindustrialization that is occurring, and that should not be inflationary. And the final element is services. Remember, people don't think of services. And indeed, 20 years ago, services was a small fraction of merchandise trade. Today, services are one-third of the merchandise trade. You basically can't do merchandise trade without attaching services. And remember, services are very different dynamics to merchandise trade cost-wise. So I'm not a great believer that deglobalization is actually inflationary, but it's certainly not disinflationary the way it used to be. The other element everybody brings up is ESG, particularly the E part of ESG. I'm worried about that part a little bit more than deglobalization, but again, I don't believe it's actually going to be significantly inflationary, but it's not disinflationary either. And so when I look at it, we have very strong disinflationary backdrop. But against that, we will have regular spikes of inflation when black swans and fat tails suddenly move us and disrupt us. And also over time, when we start relying more on the fiscal tools rather than just monetary. We're not doing it today because as soon as we got out of the problem of COVID, we basically pulled back the fiscal lever. But we now know how to use it. And therefore, every time there is a problem, we'll pull it up again. And when we do that, it will ignite another inflationary spike. As soon as we pull it back, that inflation will just drain away. And so when people say, do you think longer term inflation now will be higher than in the past on average? My answer, there will be no average. There will be highs and lows, but there will be no average. So I don't view it as a permanent state of affairs that we have inflation. Neither do I view it that disinflation is actually the permanent state of affairs. We'll be switching, or the pendulum will be switching between one and the other. And right now, as we go through 23, 24, I think both policymakers and investors will be surprised how quickly inflation will drain away. We don't, in my view, need to destroy demand in order for inflation to leak away. We just need to normalize demand and supply curves in goods markets and services market and labor market, which we're doing right now and progressing quite well. Unless there is another major upheaval coming and another major dislocation, inflation, in my view, will drain away. But it will come back, all I'm saying. It's not uniform sort of answer.
Okay, if we're going to have both inflationary and disinflationary pressures alternating, so to speak, that begs the question of how that's going to translate into an outlook for both interest rates and GDP. So why don't we start with interest rates? We'll come back to GDP.
Well, basically what it means that this idea that we're permanently repricing capital is incorrect, that what we're going to see high rates and very low rates. We're going to retest again 1% or less, and we're going to go up to 4% or more, and we're going to be back again. And therefore, this idea of repricing capital is unlikely to happen. Right now, and that's been my view since earlier 22, is that as we progress through the balance of 22, 23, and 24, interest rates will be on a downside, that we already have seen the peak of inflation, the peak of interest rate, the peak of commodity prices, and interest rates will become more accommodative. Now, the reason for that is very simple, that remember this inflationary backdrop, it's very strong. And so unless you disrupt it, it comes back. And disinflation increases. Because think about it this way, how do countries grow? They only grow by adding labor, by adding capital, and by growing productivity. Now, no matter where you look globally, ability to add labor is declining rapidly. There are some exceptions to that, like India, but generally speaking, it's declining. Number two, ability to add capital is constrained. And that leaves you with productivity. The problem is, globally, productivity has been declining for almost three decades. And there is no reason to believe that suddenly productivity will mushroom. So what it basically tells you is that our growth past longer term contracts. It gets less and less. It gets shallower and shallower. If it contracts, that means neutral rates that you require in the economy, we will become more volatile. In other words, they will jump and they'll fall, jump and fall, more volatile than what they were in the previous three decades. But over the longer term, they're not rising. Now, that basically, to me, implies that interest rates over the longer term also will have to continue falling. This idea cheap money is the end, it's finished, to me, that's just nonsense. I can't see how that's going to happen, given what we discussed, given the demographics, given inequality, given technology, given financialization, debt levels, and commitment to asset prices we have. I just can't see how neutral rates are going to go up to enable you to permanently reprice capital. So to answer your question is that we have already seen the highs of interest rates. Over the next 2 years, they're going to fall. We can debate how much that comes back to the growth picture and whether central banks must destroy demand in order to bring down inflation. My answer, as you know, is no. because it's that inflation that we have was not caused by excess demand. Most countries globally are still below the trajectory they were on prior to COVID. United States is one of the few exceptions, but even in the United States, aggregate demand is only 1% above where it would have been if there was no COVID. So to me, it's not so much excess demand, but rather disruption, disruptions that caused this inflation. If that is the case, then you normalize the disruption and inflation comes off, disinflation becomes stronger until the next element will fall off. That is, either we have another health problem or we have another geopolitical problem, or suddenly there is disruption of supply in some form occurring. And over the next 10, 15 years, we're going to get more of that compared to what we had in the previous couple of decades. And that's what drives your inflation up and down. But if you start thinking of longer term, 10, 20 years out, I think the line for interest rates is still flat to down as we progress, rather than repricing at some kind of a high level.
Let's move on to GDP and the recession outlook. A lot of people had predicted that we would be in a very deep and painful recession by right now. If that's the case, at least as of Tuesday afternoon as we're speaking, the S&P didn't get the memo. What do you see in terms of a recession in 2023? Are we still likely to have one? And what's the GDP outlook?
The way I basically described it 12 months ago, that we have three possible scenarios. And remember, S&P earnings per share is much more driven by global GDP, not by the US GDP. The correlation of R-square against global GDP is much higher compared to what it used to be 20 years ago when it was primarily driven by US GDP. So I basically had three possible scenarios. Number one is that we have a soft landing, a Goldilocks. That would imply that global GDP in 2023 will grow somewhere around 3%. Up until about 6 months ago, almost everybody were roughly in that category. Now, to me, the probability of that scenario occurring is very low. It's maybe 5, 10%. Now, what's my base case? My base case is what I describe as skirting a global recession. What do I mean by that? Global population growth rate is about 1%. So if your global GDP growing between 1.5% to 2%, that basically means you're skirting, you're very close to recession. Some countries will be in a shallow recession, some countries will grow much slower, but you're not in a fully sort of fledged recessionary global climate. Now, to me, it's a most likely outcome. And the reason for that is that, as I said earlier, I do believe inflation will come off. As inflation comes off, central banks will start changing their communication policies, which they already started to do, actually, at the end of 22 in December, when they start talking a little bit more about growth and inflation, not just about inflation. But as we progress to 23 and 24, I do expect interest rates will be cut. I do expect QT will end as we progress through 23. There is a possibility of QE into 2024. So policy settings will start changing. Fiscal settings. In 2022, global fiscal negative delta, particularly in the U.S., was incredibly large. So in other words, the governments were pulling back. So deficits were rapidly falling. In 2023, we still have a negative delta, but nothing like 22. In 24, in a lot of countries, it turns positive outside of the United States. But by 25, even in the U.S., that fiscal delta will become positive. So both monetary and fiscal policies will start changing if my view is correct, that we do not have any problem of embedding inflation in the labor, goods, or financial markets. Inflation will fall off. That opens an opportunity for policymakers to balance growth versus inflation much more constructively than what they otherwise would have done. So that's one area why I don't believe we need to destroy demand. And the other area is the fact that there is really no systemic fractures right now in our financial system. When people say, oh my God, you know, U.S. households lost over $7 trillion, which is like a combination of the Japan and Korea GDP combined, largest number ever. But people tend to forget to argue that this only gets you back to late 2021. And compared to pre-COVID, households are still 25% better off than what they were. Similarly, people are discussing housing market, that it is contracting. Yes, it is very, very true. But in terms of prices, we're only back to earlier 22. And in terms of inventory levels, we're only at 3 months or less of inventory at the time when demographics in a lot of countries, including US, are still growing. So to me, when they look at housing markets, when they look at the high yield market, look at the high yield spreads. They're barely moving above 4.5%. Even for triple C debt, which is basically bankrupt companies, it can't even reach 10%. So whether you look at a high yield market, whether you look at a housing market, whether you look at destruction of wealth, whether you look at emerging markets, think how emerging markets have survived the third strongest ever appreciation of US dollar through 2022 and the harshest increases in interest rates. How they survive. It basically tells you that emerging market universe is no longer structurally weak asset class. Over the last 10 years, they just made sure that the debt is controlled, external liabilities are controlled, the duration is controlled, et cetera, et cetera. There are some problems in the EMs, a usual suspect, Argentina, Turkey, et cetera. But for the bulk of emerging market universe, they're much better positioned. So one of the interesting things I find is today, there is not many structural fault lines that can suddenly aggravate our position in a meaningful way. To me, digital assets was one of those areas to watch. But it just was quite remarkable so far how we managed this process with a limited degree of damage. So economies are exhibiting resilience, exhibiting sort of lower than most people would have expected degree of vulnerability. And so to me, those two things combined basically says that number one, policymakers will have a room to better manage the economy over the next 12, 18 months rather than just fighting inflation. And at the same time, I don't really see the cracks in the system. Now, what will be a fully fledged destruction of demand? Well, that will happen when a global GDP goes down in terms of growth rates towards 1% or less. In other words, equivalent to global population growth. Now, what does it do for earnings per share? Well, the relationship between GDP and earnings per share is not perfect because there are many other variables in there. There is a FX and many other things, but there is a relationship. If you were to grow at roughly 3% globally, GDP, that usually translates into 10, 15% earnings per share growth rates for most places. If you grow more like 1.5% to 2% global GDP, which is my assumption, which is what I call skirting a global recession, then earnings per share should be around zero. And if you grow global economy at 1% or less, then earnings per share should drop at least 10 to 20%. So the interesting thing I find is that the analysts right now, whether you look at the global portfolios or U.S., SPX numbers, or even emerging market numbers. Over the last 6 months, analysts brought, say, in the US expectation from 10% EPS growth rates to 2 or 3. In a global portfolio, it's from 9% to around 2. In emerging markets, from 13-14% down to around 4 or 5. So there has been a very significant contraction of earnings per share expectations for 23. Now, if my scenario of skirting global recession is correct, then earnings per share numbers are still high, but they're not astronomically high anymore because you're getting very, very close to zero. Now, that would imply that, yes, you need to pull back earnings per share a little bit more, but what about risk-free rate or equity risk premium, which creates a multiple, a PE multiple. Now, risk-free rates are already down. In my view, they'll continue going down as we progress over the next 12 months. And equity risk premiums, which now relatively modest in a sense, they're just on an average historical level, could contract a little bit more because in the US, for example, you might go from 4.5% to maybe 3.5%. What it basically tells you that we've avoided the worst possible outcomes. We've avoided bankruptcies. We've avoided massive calamities. And so to me, the way I look at it, yes, you need to pull down the earnings, but risk-free rates and equity risk premiums will be lower. That means multiples are higher. And that basically tells you not a great returns out of equities because one compensates the other. But nevertheless, no need to have a 25-30% derating of equity values. That will only happen if the third scenario prevails. That is, we must destroy demand in order to avoid stickiness of inflation, and therefore global GDP goes down to 1% or less. Then there is no doubt that there is at least 25-30% that would need to be wiped out. But to me, the chances of that happening, they're there, but they're probably no more than 25%. So there is much better chance that I think we're going to skirt global recession. And by the way, World Bank just cut back their numbers for 2023 to 1.7%. And remember, given institutional constraints, they're usually the last one to do the reduction. And so that might actually mark the bottom of the cycle for GDP forecast. A more interesting question to me, therefore, if I'm correct that we are right at the bottom of those forecasts, what will happen in 2024? Because lack of recession, meaningful recession, implies lack of recovery. And if you think of earnings per share estimates for 2024, pretty uniformly, everybody is at around 9 to 13% a rebound. That might be problematic when we get there.
Victor, let's talk then about the equity outlook. Just in the last couple of days, as we're speaking on Tuesday afternoon, the S&P has moved back above both its 200-day moving average and the 38.2% retracement of the overall big move down from the highs to the bottom that we had in the last few months. So is the worst behind us? Is it all uphill from here? What do you see for the equity market?
No, it's not an uphill. Basically, what I've just described in my sort of base case scenario, that we're skirting global recession, that implies a potential very shallow recession in the United States and Eurozone. It implies emerging markets probably will grow no more than 3.5% in 2023, which is not a recession, but given that their population growth rate is much faster, it's near recessionary levels. And that implies earnings per share growth rates should be around zero. As I said, the U.S. analysts already brought down their numbers from about 10% EPS growth rates 6 months ago to something around 2 to 3%. I think there is probably 200-300 basis points to go down on those numbers. And then you have a question of risk-free rates and equity risk premiums. And as I said earlier, I think risk-free rates within 12 months will end up somewhere around 2.5 to 3 rather than going into 4. And I think equity risk premiums also will nudge down from the current level in real terms of about 4.5. Now, that implies expansion of the multiples. And so my view about 6-9 months ago was that in my core scenario, S&P should be trading between 3,600-3,700 and just over 4,000. That's where it ought to be. If, however, you think that we can have a really soft landing, as I said, to me, it's only 10% probability, and therefore global GDP expands at something like 3%, then you have a Goldilocks. You have earnings per share that quickly will be revised back up to around 10% growth rates. Yes, risk-free rates will back up again into high threes, low fours, but equity risk premium will collapse because that we've just got the best outcome. So it's a perfect outcome of rising earnings and rising multiples. That's where you will put yourself at about 5,000. If, however, you think that a global demand must be destroyed and global GDP growth rate has to go to 1% or less, implying at least 2 or 3 quarters of 50-60 bips, quarter-on-quarter declines in the U.S., for example. So much deeper recession, both in the U.S. As well as globally. Then earnings per share will drop 10-20% minimum. You will find margins in the U.S. will go from 12% to probably 8, maybe even less. In that scenario, yes, risk-free rate eventually will fall to 1% or less, but equity risk premium probably will go to 8-9% because it's a really bad outcome. So it's a very poor outcome of declining earnings and declining multiples. And that will start putting you at 2,700, sort of 3,000 on S&P. So this is your three outcomes. And so for the last 6-9 months, I was saying, you know, 36, 37 to 4,000 or low 4,000, that's where you ought to be. Now, does it mean that we can't fall below 3,600? No, it doesn't mean that. But as far as I can see, economic growth rates, resilience of the economy, leading indicators on a second derivative, in other words, the pace of decline, has already turned for the last several months. When I look at lack of fractures in the financial markets, when I look at all of that, I just think the chances of having such a destructive outcomes is diminishing on a daily basis. So to answer your question, that's what I said earlier, I don't think you should be looking for high returns, but what you can assume that this idea that we must retest the previous low or potentially go below that, to me, that's extremely unlikely. Now, when we go then into 24, the question then becomes extent to which the global economy will rebound and related issues, whether it's China, whether it's inflation, extent to which it rebounds, and what does it do for earnings per share, and whether in fact the analysts are too high for 2024. So that will put a new sets of sort of numbers for people to think about. Now, a lot of analysts said, look, first half of 23 are going to be poor. Second half of 23 is going to be much better. I don't agree. Market is a forward discounting machine. People are almost on the cusp of basically agreeing that it's not going to be an economic Armageddon. Central banks are already hedging their bets. Communication strategy is already changing. I don't think we need to go through market Armageddon and then get a really solid recovery in the end of 23. In other words, we don't need to go to 3,600 and then go up to 4,500 or something like that. I really don't buy that. Markets should be discounting all of this news earlier part of the year, which I think what the market is doing right now.
One asset that is trending sharply higher is gold, which is up fully 20% from where it bottomed in the beginning of November. What's driving the move higher, and is it set to continue?
Well, I'm not a gold specialist, but the only thing you always work with gold is real interest rates. So when real interest rates going up, and remember, in the U.S., real interest rates in September, October reached as high as 1.7, 1.8%. Now, real interest rates are now down to about 1.2, 1.3%, and the expectation that real rates just will continue falling off as we progress forward. So I don't think people are buying gold necessarily because they expect an Armageddon to occur or some kind of a meltdown of a global monetary system. I think it's. I don't think that's what's playing it. I think it's really real rates that is driving it. And if it's true that real rates will have to continue coming down, that should provide support for gold. But as I said, I'm not a gold specialist.
Victor, let's talk about the reopening of China, which has been widely anticipated. And frankly, as far as I can tell, a lot of Western observers are kind of confused and not sure what to make of the situation. How should we be interpreting that? What should we expect? And does it have an impact on inflation looking ahead?
China theoretically can have an impact on everything globally, primarily because not only it's the second largest economy and the largest trader, but it's also a massive consumer, anything from 20-30% to 80% of almost all commodities. So the way China opens up and the way they stimulate could have a significant implications for inflation, particularly in the second half of 23 and earlier part of 2024. Now, my view for the last few months was I was surprised how chaotic China's opening was. I was anticipating that opening will be very gradual towards the middle of 2023 and then much more robust later on. Instead, it was very chaotic and very rapid. And so the question then becomes, what does it do? Now, in the first quarter and by most of the second quarter, I think this opening will actually depress demand in China, and therefore China actually will negatively impact both GDP growth rates globally as well as inflation. But then as we adjust to a much higher COVID infection rates, as the healthcare system stabilizes, as consumers come back, and remember the buildup of savings in China was broadly equivalent to what happened in the United States a couple of years ago. And so when they come back and start drawing down the savings, that's where Chinese economy in the second half of 23 could start zooming at 7-8% quite easily, and that will go into the first half of 2024. So the question then becomes how China is going to grow. Because one of the things Chinese leadership have been trying to do for the last 2 or 3 years is to avoid further deterioration in efficiency of capital utilization. Essentially, over the last 15 years, China put just too much capital into the system. And so if you think of incremental capital output ratio, how much do you get out of deploying capital? They've deteriorated from $3 to $1 to $8 to $10 for every of investment for every dollar of GDP. And so China tries to constrain to which capital, a deterioration of efficiency of capital occurring. Now, that basically implies that they try to contain infrastructure and real estate as much as possible. And it is infrastructure and real estate that provides bulk of the impact in the commodity markets. And so to me, it's more than likely that China will do that. They will continue constraining it. Yes, there will be more demand from households, consumption. Yes, there will be burning probably at least 600,000, maybe 700,000 extra barrels of oil as we go towards the end of the year. But that is not enough to overcome weakness everywhere else globally. And so my view remains that China could dislocate global economies, they could dislocate demand, they could dislocate supply and inflation, but more likely they will be mildly inflationary, but no major dislocation, primarily because, as I said, what China trying to do, where China trying to invest, how China is trying to grow. The other thing to remember is that a lot of capacity will come into the marketplace too, capacity that was constrained over the last couple of years. And that implies some of the disinflation will also start coming through into global system. So to me, if I were to think of three most important things to watch out over the next 12, 18 months, one of it will be clearly healthcare and any possibility globally that we dislocate demand supply curves. Secondly, will be geopolitics, again, that we're going to dislocate it. And the third one, watch China. And how does China recover? And what sort of growth rates China will be able to maintain after they recover from COVID? A lot of people say, wouldn't you, Victor, include policy errors? My answer is no. I think the probability of perpetuation of policy errors right now is actually very low. To me, those will be the three key elements to watch.
Now, a lot of people have become very concerned that a conflict between China and Taiwan might be imminent. But I think you said earlier, you're actually fading that. Why do you see that as less likely?
Primarily because of what happened in Russia-Ukraine and how West reacted to what happened in Russia-Ukraine. That gives, in my view, China a pause. They need to think, how do you fight? What army do you need? What resources do you need? They also need to think of retrofitting their monetary system and their economic system, much more than what they would have thought about it prior to Russia-Ukraine war. Because, as I said, you can't escape it. You can't just say, well, I've got to sell US dollar. And I say, buy what? You buy yen, it's not going to help you. Euro, it's not going to help you. Pound sterling, it's not going to help you. What are you going to do? You're going to buy camels and sands and exchange, you know, camels for oil? Or how are you going to structure it? When, remember, the liquidity of Russian ruble market or Iranian currency market or even renminbi is a fraction what China needs. There are very few currencies and securities that can provide the type of liquidity that the world's second largest economy and the world's largest trader demand. And so to me, that doesn't mean that China will not lash out regularly. They will. It doesn't mean that there won't be tensions. There will be. But I think the probabilities of anything major happening in 23, 24, probably even beyond that, is actually lower today than what they were prior to Russia-Ukraine war. When we last time talked in January 2022, I would have thought it's probably a higher probability than it is today.
Victor, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview. But before I let you go, please tell our listeners a little bit more about what you do at Macquarie and where they can follow your work.
Sure. I'm a global equity strategy at Macquarie Capital, based in New York now. I was based for 10 years in Hong Kong with Macquarie. And what I do is essentially equity strategy, global, Asia Pacific. And the best way to sort of to get hold of what I do and write every day is to become a client of Macquarie.
Patrick Ceresna, Nick Galarnik, and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right after this.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it was great to have Victor on the show. Now, joining us again in the postgame is Nick Galarnik. Let's get to that chart deck. Listeners, you'll find the download link for the postgame chart deck in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, it means you're not yet registered at macrovoices.com. Just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com, and click on the red button over Victor's picture that says looking for the downloads. Now, Nick, let's get to talking some of these charts. On page 2, I have that S&P 500. What levels are you watching?
Yeah, so spot right now is 4030 on SPX. Expected move currently for the February 17th OPEX is 150 points or 3.7% in either direction. So the upper expected move there is 4180. We're currently sitting just above that strong resistance area of 4000, which seems to have broken for now. Next pivot would be 4120 area or so. And obviously, if we continue with the upward momentum that we've seen the past week or so, that should hit in the next, I'd say probably the next few days. Lower expected move would be 3880. Again, this is the February 17th OPEX. Support 3800, then 3700 with lows of 3500 acting as heavy support. And we have the jobs data coming out later today, as well as real GDP. And then tomorrow we have consumer sentiment. So that should cause a move in the markets. But Eric, what are your thoughts here on the S&P?
Well, we've got four daily closes now above the 200-day moving average, which is co-located with the 38.2% Fibonacci retracement of the big move down from 4,800 to the recent lows. So that's a new record in this cycle. In the previous advances above the 200-day moving average, it had only gotten up for two or three daily closes. Now we've got four already closed, and it looks like so far it's a green candle on the day today, although it's before the open when I'm recording. If we get another up candle today, that would be five daily closes in a row. Maybe we are going to hold above and move higher. As far as upside targets from here, the 50% retracement would be 4153. The 61.8% retracement would be 4308. So I think 4308 is kind of the cap on how far a bear market rally can go. Once you're beyond the 61.8, statistically, it's more likely at that point that it's going to continue all the way back to new all-time highs. I don't think that we're headed for that. I think this is a bear market rally. So I think it ends somewhere between where it is right now and 4308 on the S&P. Where in that range? Frankly, I have no idea.
Yeah, the interesting thing about the S&P 500 for me is the fact that so far every dip's been bought, and each time it's more or less a retracement. What I did on the chart was put the 50-day moving average, which at least over the last couple of weeks, once we broke above it in January, it really has acted as short-term support. And while I personally still anticipate a bear market decline of some sort this year, it's clear that this is not the moment in the cycle and its earnings are not the catalyst. The one thing to watch is all the major central banks are talking next week between the FOMC, the ECB, and the Bank of England, all within a 24-hour window. And while between now and then, the prevailing market trends are the path of least resistance, the interesting thing that I'm going to be watching is whether by the time that we're recording next week's episode, whether they have triggered some sort of new trend moves to begin. So what is interesting is, Nick, that you're talking about that overhead level of 4180, and that is definitely a short-term target. And what I think is very plausible here is the market continues to edge higher and crawl higher until it's in the prevailing trends, until a catalyst emerges. And at this moment, its earnings have not been that catalyst. So maybe the FOMC may offer that. And that's certainly one of the things that I'm watching. So let's move on to the NASDAQ chart on page 3. I have the QQQs here. And for me anyway, this has been making some meaningful progress. It tested that key support line and is now approaching those December highs. What are the implied ranges here, bud?
Yeah, so looking at the triple Qs, we have February 17th OPEX, current spot is around 290. Expected move for that expiration date is about 14 points or 4.8%. The upper move would be around 304. Again, resistance is right now at the current level we're at, 290 or so, with a gap way above at 310 or so. Lower expected move is 276, again, for the February 17th OPEX. Support is heavy at 260 and then 254, which are the lows from October. We had Microsoft reporting on Tuesday. They had a pretty poor report overall. Stock was flat yesterday. We came down heavily on that and then finished the day pretty much flat, which was pretty impressive. Tesla last night reported they beat on the top and the bottom. Free cash flow came in pretty weak overall. But again, the stock is up right now as we speak. And then we have Apple and Google next week reporting as well. So more heavy hitters on deck next week.
Nick, I wanted to actually move on to the VIX chart on page 4. And usually when a market is calm and progressing higher, it usually is under a period of volatility contraction. And that trend really continues. I mean, you can draw a clean trend line along all those highs, just showing how volatility is persistently making lower highs in and gravitating to that all those key lows around 20. What's your take on the VIX here?
Yeah, so as I said, over the past few weeks, we've seen consolidation in the VIX around the 20 area. And over the last year or so, we've seen small pullbacks to the 20 area as well, which have been short-lived, typically often followed by a massive spike in the VIX. So right now, I think we're waiting for earnings season to finish up before we get that big move that we should see, you know, either up or down in the next month or so. Current spot VIX is around 19.26. Expected daily moves based on that in broad markets are around 1.2%. Put to call volume right now is about 0.05, which means that roughly 20 times the number of calls are being opened per put, which is very bullish on the VIX and very bearish on broad markets. Put to call interest is 0.32. So we have roughly 3 times the number of calls being opened per put. Again, bullish on the VIX, bearish on broad markets. And key level, as I've stated previously, is 25. If we break this, could see a major run to 30 or 35, which would coincide with a larger leg down as well. So on page 5 here, we have the US dollar index, which is in a severe downtrend. What are you making of this right here?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think that this really has been the macro tailwind. When the dollar put in its short-term high and began this contraction, when we had that big pullback in the U.S. dollar yen, when the euro and pound both had substantial rebounds, this became the backdrop for alleviating a lot of the stresses on everything from emerging markets to global equity. But this dollar trend continues, and it's been a huge tailwind for gold. It's been a huge tailwind for so many other asset classes. And in what I'm going to 100% be watching is whether or not the central banks next week are going to become the catalyst for potentially creating new volatility in the dollar. I still am in the camp that when we go through another risk-off cycle, that it certainly would have a bullish impulse on the dollar. But there's clearly no sign of that today. And it probably going into those central bank meetings is going to be just more of the same here. But will we get a U.S. dollar reversal next week is one of the interesting things that I'm going to be watching.
Now, moving on to page 6 here, we have the charts on gold, which are currently making highs, recent highs, and looking like we're going to possibly break out above that 2000 area and possibly push to new all-time highs. Eric, what are your thoughts on gold?
Well, the only thing not to love about gold here is that it hasn't given us many pullbacks to allow opportunities for new longs to enter this market. Looking at the chart, gold is what I call jump the tracks, which is my own terminology for when you've got something trading inside of a channel, as gold was. It breaks above the channel resistance line as it did and establishes a new channel. So what used to be the channel resistance line becomes the channel support line, and a new parallel channel resistance line forms above that. That's exactly what's happened. We've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 tests of that new upper channel resistance line, which right now is at 1950, hit that overnight. The bottom of that channel is down at about 1912, and it looks like we're on the way down this morning, 1935 or so as I speak. We really haven't seen in the last couple of weeks anything below the 8-day moving average, which right now is at 1926. So that would be where you'd expect to see the buying point if we're going to see another, you know, daily fluctuation like we've been seeing up and down between the 8-day moving average and the top of that new formative trend line resistance level. But hey, an 8-day test, you know, there's lots of room below that. We could get all the way back down to 1840 or so and not violate the channel support line in the old channel, the lower channel, before it jumped the tracks. So it's awfully daring to try to get in this late in the game with new money. Makes more sense to wait for a pullback, but boy, this market hasn't given us a decent pullback.
Yeah, Eric, you know, your comments are somewhat in line with mine. Almost every rally is checked at some point, and there's certainly going to be a period where gold's rise is going to have some sort of pullbacks. The bigger question in my mind is, will gold generally be well defended during corrections? I think those are the really important things to watch. Nick, you were talking about gold going to all-time new highs. While I think that this year that will be the case, I really do still anchor off of the fact that this entire gold move correlates very, very well with the dollar decline. And what the dollar does next will be a huge play in terms of whether or not gold actually can clear 2,000 in this trend impulse. I think next week we're going to find out. But one way or another, I think that for new positioning in gold, waiting for dips is going to be an important way to reset the asymmetry of the trade. Nonetheless, I wanted to move on to page 7 where I got the crude oil chart. This is the March contract. And we had crude oil nicely consolidating, but the failure of it to actually break above some fib levels around this 82-83 still have not confirmed that a new bull impulse has begun. Actually, in fact, a failure at these levels could usher in a retest of its previous lows. In the bigger picture, have a bull angle on crude oil and think it's going much higher. And so to me, one of the most important things to see whether a new bull trend is starting is whether or not it can get into these mid-80s, and then suddenly we see the pattern of higher highs and higher lows start to emerge that will start a potential new trend. But what's interesting is on page 8 is I have those natural gas futures, and boy, has this been an ugly sell cycle. We now, this morning, find natural gas futures trading under $3. At this stage, there's a number of measure moves that even suggest $2.50 on the downside. But the way I kind of am perceiving this is, okay, well, the move from $10 down to $3 has already happened. And while there's volatility risk and very heavy distribution, at some juncture down here, I think we're very close to a tradable low. But even though we're close to that low, it may not necessarily result in a new bull trend, but rather the level where nat gas may consolidate. The interesting thing is, from a seasonality perspective, you know, much of the winter is already been priced in. So the question then is, do we have to wait until the second half of the year to see a more meaningful turn up in natural gas? And so while I think the lows are slowly coming in here, I don't necessarily, I'm not too eager to rush to be buying here.
Folks, if you enjoy Patrick's Chart Ticks, you can get them every single day of the week with a free trial of Big Picture Trading. The details are on the last pages of the slide deck, or just go to bigpicturetrading.com. This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by Respect Energy, a leading European trader of renewable energy and a one-stop shop for all green energy investors. Patrick, tell them what they can expect to find in this week's Research Roundup.
Well, in this week's Research Roundup, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to the chart book we just discussed here in the post game, and a number of links to articles that we found interesting. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup.
Well, that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners and are always looking for suggestions on how we can make this program even better. For those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account @macrovoices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter @EricSTownsend. That is Eric spelled with a K. And follow Patrick @PatrickSerezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend, Patrick Serezna, and myself, thanks for listening and see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week, free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.